So we are doing these applications, and so in last two lectures we discussed the gravitational waves, and that was actually pretty tough. So we had to introduce the gravitational energy momentum tensor. We had to use the retarded potential formula to actually calculate what the fields are. And so in the end, we derived this beautiful quadrupole formulae. So one of them is for the metric perturbation. And of course, we were interested in the radiative field. So h mu nu falls off like 1 over r in that quadrupole formula. And it's proportional to the quadrupole and to derivatives, to time derivatives of the quadrupole. And then if you are interested in the power, how much energy per time is radiated away, it's actually 3 derivatives of the quadrupole square. All right, and so this was tested in 1974 in this beautiful binary system where you had the pulsar. And so what was happening is that people observed that the pulses actually are getting shorter and shorter. And so, of course, as the thing's going closer and closer, this is speeding up. And this is due to the fact that the system is losing gravitational, well, it's losing energy due to radiation of gravitational waves. And this precisely matched the prediction of this quadrupole formula. So then this was awarded a Nobel Prize. So anyway, so now I would like to actually start discussing some exact solutions of Einstein theory. So far we basically discussed the gravitational waves in the linearized gravitational theory in the weak field regime. So now let's just write down an exact solution of Einstein equations. So part B is the Schwarzschild solution. And what is actually quite interesting is that when Einstein wrote down his equations, he thought that they are so horrible that nobody will ever find out any exact solutions. And so he only himself found these perturbative solutions. And then it took Schwarzschild only basically a couple of months to come up with his solution. And so that was the first exact solution was sent to Einstein for a review, and Einstein was super happy that somebody actually can solve his equations. Unfortunately for Schwarzschild, that was the time of the First World War. So this was in 1916. And so Schwarzschild actually died as a consequence of the First World War. So he got some illness and died shortly after he published his solution.
So Einstein actually got a solution before First War.
Did he? I don't think so. No. So.
About that. That
no. I. Okay. Maybe so. All right. So now my story is broken. Anyway. So. So here is the metric.
Sorry about that.
Schwarzschild metric. And so what it is, it's given by the following metric. So it's d square is minus f dt square plus dr square over the same function f and plus r square d omega square, where the omega square is just a metric on the sphere. So it's d theta square plus sine square theta d phi square. So we have some coordinates t, which is like a time coordinate. We have a coordinate r, which is the radial coordinate. And then we have coordinates theta and phi on the sphere. And so metric function f is just given by 1 minus 2m over r. And that's the metric. And it's an exact solution of vacuum Einstein equations. So this is an exact solution of vacuum Einstein equations, and we know that these can be written as r mu nu equals to 0. All right, and because there's this sphere here, and everything depends only on the radial coordinate r, so there's a spherical symmetry to this solution. So the solution is actually spherically symmetric. Exact solution of r mu nu, and this is spherically symmetric. So you now you notice that everything is, you know, pretty simple. So there's only this metric function f, which takes this form 1 minus 2m over r. M is an integration constant. So if you are trying to solve your Einstein equations, of course, these are partial differential equations. And if you integrate them, there is one freedom. There's a integration constant, which is this m here. So m here is the integration constant and so it is a constant. So now if you remember your homework number 2 when you were studying the linearized gravity, you noticed that the metric in the linearized gravity can be written as the flat metric plus a small perturbation, and the small perturbation in the convenient type of coordinates look like that GTT had 1 minus 2 phi over c square, where phi was the Newtonian potential, and the same phi was also in the spatial part of the metric. So it was 1 minus 1 plus 2 phi times dx square plus dy square plus dz square. So now if you look at this thing here, and you think, well, if I go with r super far, if r goes to infinity, this term becoming super small. Okay, so then f is basically 1. And if f is 1, then this is just minus dt square plus dr square plus r square d omega square. So it's just a flat metric written in spherical coordinates. So now that as r goes to infinity, we recover flat metric in spherical coordinates. And you know, more generally, I can actually do the expansion when m is much, much smaller than r. So I'm looking, you know, very far away. So more generally, for m much, much smaller than r, well, the first term is what it is, so ds square goes like, so now it's minus 1 minus 2m over r, that remains the same thing, right? But then I have 1 over f. So then I have dr square over f, so it's 1 over f. And so this will become now 1 plus 2m over r. So plus 1 plus 2m over r dr square, and then plus dr square d omega square. Okay, so which almost looks like your linearized metric, right? So it almost looks like I have minus dt square plus dr square plus r square d omega square plus h mu nu, where, you know, so if I call this thing here a potential, Newtonian potential, well, this is the minus as well. So phi Newton is minus m over r. Then you are seeing that basically this should correspond to some source. And then there's minus 2 phi here, and there's a plus 2 phi the other way around. Plus 2 phi here, minus 2 phi here. And so you see that this object sort of should correspond to a massive object with the Newtonian potential m over r, so to a massive object with mass m. Okay, so this should approximately be a gravitational field of an object with mass m, right? You're just doing this Newtonian limit and comparing to what you have done in your homework. So it's not quite, because you would have to have this 1 plus 2m over r standing in front of the whole thing here, right? So not only in front of the r square, but in front of the whole spatial part. But of course, you can rename now r to something else, and so you change r to r tilde, and then you can take this out, and then you can make it work precisely. Okay, so anyway, so the statement is correct. So really this corresponds to something like a massive object of mass m, gravitational field of a massive object of mass m. And that's the physical meaning of this integration constant. All right, so now why do we care? Of course, this solution is super important. And it's one of three solutions of Einstein equations everybody should know. So one of them is the flat space. The other one is the Schwarzschild solution. We will see that it describes a field of a star or a planet or actually a black hole solution. And finally, it's the Friedmann-Robinson-Walker metric for our universe. Okay, so these are the three solutions everybody should know. We already know two of them, so it's great. So now the importance is captured by this Birkhoff's theorem. And so what it says is that this solution, so the Schwarzschild solution, is the most general spherically symmetric solution of vacuum Einstein equations. Okay, so that's the significance. So basically, if you want to find a spherically symmetric solution and you demand that this is a solution of vacuum Einstein equations, then this is the only thing there is. There is nothing else. So when I ask you, I already told you that question, but when I ask you in the interview, are there spherically symmetric gravitational waves? Well, gravitational waves are in vacuum, right? And so spherically symmetric solution, they would have to be of this form. So what I hope to convince you is that this is not a gravitational wave. This is something else. All right, so that's the beautiful theorem. So now notice that actually the solution has more symmetry than just the spherical symmetry. If you look at the solution, it actually does not depend on time, right? The function f just depends on r, and everything else depends on r and sine theta, but it does not depend on t. So now you had a tutorial about Killing vectors, and you know that actually if there's a Killing vector, I can make the metric independent of the corresponding coordinate. And so what this is telling you is that actually there is a time-like Killing vector. So note that we have extra symmetry, namely that the solution is static. Solution is static. So that means that there is a psi equal to dt Killing vector, which is hypersurface orthogonal, so that it's static, but it doesn't matter for us. So there's this extra symmetry, which corresponds to the fact that the metric is independent of time coordinate. Yes?
Is the fact that it is static an assumption in the Birkhoff theorem? Or
what do you think? Well, if it were, I would write it here, right? So it is not. So you can show, and you will show in a minute, that actually, if you have spherical symmetry and you have vacuum Einstein equations, staticity already follows. All right, so this has far-reaching consequences. So for example, well, okay, so outside of a planet, we have vacuum. And let's say the planet is spherically symmetric. So then we know that outside of the planet, the metric has to look like this. It has to be Schwarzschild metric. But now say, I want to study more complicated case where my planet, or let's say a star, is actually collapsing. Okay, so now nothing is static about the star. The star suddenly starts collapsing inside. But let's say that it collapses in such a way that that it stays spherically symmetric. So then, no matter what the star is doing, whatever complicated motions is doing, it's collapsing or it's exploding or whatever, as long as it remains spherically symmetric, the metric outside will still be Schwarzschild solution. and it will be static. This is a beautiful thing and beautiful consequence of the spherical symmetry and vacuum Einstein equations. All right, so that's the statement. So let's prove the statement. Of this Berkhoff's theorem. So now you can spend almost infinite time trying to prove this statement. And typically people discussing first course in general, as they do, they spend the whole lecture trying to derive this result. So let me maybe spend 5 minutes on this. So the first step is that we want to construct a solution which is spherically symmetric. Okay, so let's start with the most general spherically symmetric solution. Spherically symmetric metric. Of course, I need to impose that it's a solution later on. All right, so what does a spherical symmetry means? It means that if I fix, let's say, radius and fix time, then my metric has to look like sphere. So what it means is that my metric, ds square, has to have a part, whatever there is, it has to have d omega square, right? So if I set the other two coordinates equal to a constant, I have to recover a sphere, right? So now this sphere can have some radius. So whatever stands here in front of the omega square corresponds to the radius of the sphere. So now you can choose whatever the radius you want, basically, but there is some nice gauge choices. So one of the gauge choices is the one that you say that actually if you have a sphere of radius r, it simply has the area 4 pi r square. Okay, that's called the area gauge. So if I choose here r square, then I am in the area gauge, and it's simply telling me, yeah, so if I am at a radius r equal to 1, my surface of the sphere will just be 4 pi. Okay, and you can always do that. Very good. So that's our first part of the metric. Second part of the metric is that we have two-dimensional sector, where better we have something like time, and we better have something like the radius r. Okay. So now we have a two-dimensional metric. So in general, you will have GTP component, GTR component, and GRR component. But bloody, this is just a two-dimensional metric, right? And I can always diagonalize it. So if you start with a matrix which is 2x2 matrix, I can always use diagonalization procedure. So in other words, I can always kill GTR component. So all I am left with is GTT component and GRR component. Okay, so let's write them. So let's write them in a clever way. So let's write, not enough space. This is my GTT component. Doesn't look nice. So it's exponential to 2 psi times a function f dt square, and then plus dr square over f. Okay, so that's my ansatz. So I have an arbitrary function here, which stands for my GTT component. And so I write that function GTT with the help of a function of psi and with the help of a function of f. And then I have a GRR component here. And this is 1 over f. This is my GRR. And the fact that there is no GTR component is simply I can always diagonalize my 2x2 matrix. Okay, so this is our most general spherically symmetric metric. So every spherically symmetric metric after gauge fixing, after choosing some gauge, then is always described by at most 2 functions. I just use these functions psi and f. So, yes? You are not breaking any symmetries. You are just choosing, you know, whatever the area of the sphere of radius r is. And you can choose that to be
which symmetry this gauge fixing is related.
So I am fixing, so I have a symmetry of doing any coordinate transformation. So I'm fixing coordinates so that this is true.
And when you're saying that it is static, when you said the example of the Earth, I was like, no, it is not static.
Okay.
So I don't understand.
Okay, let's go back to that in a minute. So please remember that question. Let's go back. Okay, so the statement is every spherically symmetric metric is just described by two functions. And so in our case, it's just psi. And of course, these functions are functions of my coordinates of r and t. Okay, they cannot be function of theta, but they can be function of r and t, because if they were function of theta, I would break the spherical symmetry. So this is it. So I have two functions, and this is my most general spherically symmetric metric. All right. So now the next step is the following trick. Oh, that's not good. I just choose to write for no reason that my function f, so let parametrize f, let f simply looks like 1 minus 2m new function over r, and this is a function of r and t. Okay? So why not? Okay, so why not? I'm just parametrizing one function of r and t in terms of a new function, m, which is a new function of r and t. All right, so we can still do this. So now it's the time to impose the vacuum Einstein equations. Okay, so now impose r mu nu equals to zero. Of course, in order to do this, this is our ansatz for the metric. This is the metric. So now we have to do all the GR machinery. We have to calculate the Christoffel symbols. We have to calculate the Riemann tensor. We have to calculate the Einstein tensor, or the Ricci tensor, and we have to set it equal to zero. Okay. So then this is some work, but of course Mathematica will do it in no time for you. And then you find that actually you have only three independent Einstein equations. Okay, or let's say more generally, this is instructive. Let's assume the full Einstein equations. So g mu nu equals to 8 pi g mu nu, and then we will of course set g mu nu equal to zero. Okay, so if you just do it more generally, this is the t mu nu, what you find is the following equation. So we have only three equations are independent, and they give you dm over dr is equal to 4 pi r squared minus ttt. Okay, so one index is up, one index is down. That's the first equation. Second equation is that dm over dt is minus 4 pi r square minus t tr. And the last equation is that d psi over dr is 4 pi r divided by f minus t tt plus tr r. Okay, so that's the three equations which you get out of here. I hope nobody is trying to do it online now, but yeah, that's what you get if you use Mathematica. Okay, so this is for any metric like this and for any source, t mu nu. It's only these sources TTT, TRR, and TTR which enter here. So if you are in vacuum, t mu nu is equal to zero. So in vacuum, t mu nu equals to zero. And so the first two equations, well, they tell you that dm over dr is zero and dm over dt is zero. So the only possibility is that small m is actually equal to a constant. Okay, so then the first two equations tell you that m equals to constant. That's the solution of the first two equations. And then the solution of the second equation of the last equation is telling you d psi over dr is equal to zero. Okay, so what does it mean? Is that psi is independent of r, so psi can be a function of t. So the last equation tells me psi is only a function of t. So we almost achieved the thing. But now look at the metric again, where psi actually enters this metric. So it's through this exponential of 2 psi times f times dt squared. So the only appearance of psi in the metric is multiplied by dt squared. But note that we have the term e to 2 psi dt squared, and that is f as well. All right. So now this psi is a function of time only, right? And so what I can do is that I can go from time to some new time tilde, where I said that this is equal to d tilde t squared, right? So what I'm saying is that dt times e to psi is dt tilde. Such a transformation is certainly possible. This is a function of one variable. This is a function of one variable. So I can always rename time coordinate t to some new time coordinate t tilde. And so then this will be true. And so then my metric, of course, just becomes ds, well, e to 2 psi disappears. And I just have minus f dt squared dr squared over f. But f is given by my ansatz, 1 minus 2m, which is now a constant divided by r. So that's the proof. So you just showed that basically, yes, I can choose this metric to be static. And it is a static metric. OK, so the staticity already comes out from the fact that you have vacuum Einstein equations. All right, are there any questions? Well, that's the proof. So really, every spherically symmetric solution of vacuum Einstein equations looks like this. Looks like Schwarzschild metric. All right, so now, if you look at the metric, you see some potential problems, right? So the metric has the metric function f. So if you are sufficiently far away from so r is sufficiently big, this is just a flat metric and there's no problem. But as r is actually smaller and smaller, you may encounter some unexpected things. So in particular, you notice that actually the first term in the metric can vanish. For which r that happens? R to m, exactly. So now unexpected things. And so first unexpected thing is that when r equals to r plus equals to 2m, then we see that f is actually 0. And so your metric breaks down, right? So now we have the first term disappears, and then we divide by 0, so that's infinity. So certainly metric is ill-defined here. So we observe a singularity in the metric. Well, that seems problematic. However, there's another problem, as if you even keep decreasing r below this. So something strange also happens when r equals to what?
0.
When r equals to 0, of course, then f actually blows up. And then I have another problem. So the other problem is r equal to 0. And then it's also a singularity. So now the question is, do we have to care, right? Do we have to care that the metric actually is singular? And you know, do we need to understand what's actually happening at r equal to 2m? Or do we need to understand what's happening at r equal to 0? So take a planet, for example, the Earth. Okay. So then you know what the mass of the Earth is, so you know what m is. And then, of course, this is in the natural units, but there's something like c squared standing at the bottom here, right? So then the question is, you know, what is this radius r plus for the Earth? And you will find that, well, Earth is quite big, several thousand kilometers. But you'll find that actually the radius r plus, if you calculate it, is 3 centimeters. Okay, so 3 centimeters with respect to 10,000 kilometers of the radius of the Earth. Okay, so you see that actually for a planet, this radius is much, much smaller than the radius of the planet. And if that is the case, of course, if you are inside the planet, you are not in vacuum, right? That is the matter composing the planet. Of course, in that case, I cannot apply the solution. So actually for a planet or for a star or whatever, this actually does not matter, because this solution does not apply to it. The radius r plus is much, much smaller than the radius of the planet, but if we are inside the planet, we cannot use this solution. So this does not matter. For planets and stars and whatever. So people didn't really, you know. But anyway, so now let's say that actually I want to look at this. And so let's say there is an object for which it could matter, right? So maybe there is an exotic object. Maybe there is an exotic object for this actually, this applies, for which this applies. Is physical. Okay, so then you really, you know, this object has to be supermassive, right? So I have to compress the mass m into teeny tiny radius, which is smaller than this r plus radius. Okay, the corresponding object is called black hole. This is called a black hole. And of course, there was a big discussion whether these things do exist. So first, people actually were really puzzled by the singularity of the metric at r plus equals to 2m. And so this was not understood until 60s, that actually this singularity here, the first one at r equal to 2m, is just a coordinate singularity. It just means that your coordinates break down at r equal to 2m. But if I change to a different coordinate system, then my spacetime is well defined, and I can go through r equal to r plus. Okay, and so that was really the origin of when people started understanding black holes, and that this solution is also applicable for objects which are actually smaller than this 2m. Okay, so the first one. So r equal to r plus equals to 2m is just a coordinate singularity, whatever that means. We shall see in a minute, or maybe tomorrow, coordinate singularity. And so, you know, we can remove it by the change of coordinates. So really, the metric is degenerate in these coordinates, but it simply means that our coordinate patch, which describes our manifold, actually ends here. And we need to use a different coordinate patch. Okay, so this actually disappears for new coordinates. On the other hand, the singularity at r equal to 0 is actually a fatal singularity. So how would you know that there is no coordinate transformation which can remove that singularity? Is that you look at some physical property. So for example, the tidal forces goes to r equal to 0. If the tidal forces are infinite, then of course the gravity tears you apart, and you have a problem, right? So gravity can only have finite tidal forces in order for this to be well defined. So let's look at a scale. So on the other hand, r equal to 0 is actually a true singularity. True singularity. And one one way to check this is really, let's look at the magnitude of the tidal forces. So for example, let's consider a scalar, which is true, but the value of the scalar is the same in any coordinate system. So if it diverges in one coordinate system, it will diverge in any other coordinate system as well. So consider, and the corresponding scalar is called Kretschmann scalar. So e.g., for example, the Kretschmann scalar and that's given by R alpha beta gamma delta. So we know that the tidal forces are described by the Riemann tensor square R alpha beta gamma delta. And what do you find? That this is given by 48 m square divided by R to the 6. Okay, so the magnitude of the tidal forces is given by this formula here, and you see that at r equal to 0, this simply blows up. So this goes to infinity as r goes to 0. Okay, and so there will be infinite tidal forces at r equal to 0, and that means you have actually singularity in your mind. All right, and of course this will be true in any coordinate system, right? Because this is a scalar. Yes.
Since we have to dismiss what we did at r equals r plus, couldn't we have like another solution for r inside of r plus?
Like, whether you can continuously join it?
Uh-huh.
Maybe you can. Well, we'll be joining to some solution. but okay, if I take this solution for granted everywhere, right? So that's what we are trying to do. So we either are describing a planet, and then we say the solution is only valid outside of the planet, and then we are safe. We don't have to care about these problems. Or actually, we want to make sense of this solution for every r, right? So all the way up to r equal to 0. And then we encounter first r equal to 2m problem, but we can remove that by doing a coordinate transformation. But then we encounter r equal to 0 problem, and then we cannot remove this. Is a question?
Yeah.
No. Okay, just stretching. That's good. Okay. So, but now this is sort of super bad and super amazing, right? We just found a solution of Einstein equations, the simplest Einstein equations, the vacuum Einstein equations, but we see that the solution breaks down at r equal to zero. So what it means is that basically at r equal to zero, the structure of the manifold breaks down. The point r equal to zero actually has to be removed from the manifold. It's not part of the manifold. But, you know, our assumption of starting with general relativity was we are given a manifold and we are trying to solve for the metric on that manifold. And the manifold is nice and smooth and looks like r to the n everywhere, right? But now we just found that it doesn't look like r to the n at r equal to 0. So actually, general relativity predicts its own doom. And this is amazing because you don't need any other theory to tell you that your theory is wrong. The theory itself tells you that it's wrong. Okay, so Einstein theory predicts its own doom. And this is really an amazing property. No any other theory will actually tell you this, right? So already, you know, Einstein's theory tells you I'm wrong. And of course, what people are hoping for is maybe that the quantum gravity effects, that the quantum effects will actually resolve the singularity. But so far, actually, there is not really indication that this is the case. Okay, so maybe removed by quantum gravity, but this is still just a hope. Okay, so maybe there are no true singularities in nature, but you don't have any indication that it's the case, at least by now. All right, so basically, okay, so now what is this solution good for? So what is it good for? So I already told you basically. So either, yes?
Yes, so why did we have the function, why did we have f like that? We didn't.
Oh, we just solved for it, right? So when I was doing this derivation, I said, well, you write the metric in this form. That's the most general form you can write down. You can always do that. And then I was just saying, well, let's write f in this form. It's just trading one function of r and t to another function of r and t. It just simplifies your calculation, but doesn't give you anything new or whatever. You don't lose any solutions by doing that, right? And then we solve Einstein equations, and we find f is indeed given by 1 minus 2, but m must be a constant divided by r. So we found f by solving the Einstein equations. So this is really fixed by imposing the Einstein equations. That's, yeah. All right, so of course the most, well, one of, well, both applications very important, right? So one application is really gravitational field of spherical stars and planets and whatever. So anything that is spherical. So of course the idea is that you have your planet here, which is spherically symmetric, and then this has the radius, which is of course much, much bigger than r plus. Okay. And so the planet, you know, there's some t mu nu inside. So t mu nu here is non-trivial. So you have some star composed of some matter. So it's not good. R is the radius, much, much bigger than r plus. It's not the Ricci scalar, it's the radius. And t mu nu is not total zero here. But if you are outside, t mu nu is equal to zero, so we are in vacuum, and the space-time is spherically symmetric because it's produced by a spherically symmetric object, and so here we have to have Schwarzschild. So to the first approximation, the field, gravitational field outside of Earth is described by Schwarzschild metric, or the field outside of the sun is described by Schwarzschild metric. Or the field outside of a ball is described by the Schwarzschild metric, right? So that's the application to planets and stars and whatever. The other application is, of course, that we understand the solution all the way to r equal to zero. So second application is that of the black hole interpretation. Black hole interpretation, and it's we understand all the way. Solution is valid all the way to r equal to zero, basically. Well, not quite, but yeah. So this is what we assume. So we assume that really we can stress the we can push the matter to a radius which is smaller than r plus. So all the matter, all the mass m is contained within r plus. Then we see this r equal to r plus, which is this coordinate singularity. And so this r plus then is called a black hole horizon. R plus is the radius of black hole horizon. Basically gives you the boundary of the black hole. And of course, you know, it took some convincing that objects like black holes can, yeah?
It's just a question, like, we have a Schwarzschild metric outside the planet, but inside the planet, there is a metric determined by t mu nu, the solution, and we want to connect both.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But for the Schwarzschild, we only have one parameter, which is m. But the inside, we have the impression that mass and pressure will be important. So we're gonna.
And we have, yeah, that's right, exactly. So you have to specify what the t mu nu is for if you want to describe a star, for example, or a planet. So you have to provide non-trivial t mu nu. Typically, what is done for relativistic stars is that you just say that the t mu nu is that of the perfect fluid. So you say it has some density and it has some pressure. And then I have to solve these equations, which are written here, but now for non-trivial density and non-trivial pressure. And then you get some inner solution for your relativistic star. And this solution better matches the Schwarzschild solution when they meet. So on the surface of the star, the metric better be nice and smooth. So that's what you have to do. But of course, that would take a lot of time.
Did people imagine that black holes existed? Like, were they looking out of this map? Did they think of objects that would properties, or did they find...
Well, people were super puzzled by this, right? And so, of course, definitely Einstein didn't know about this. And, you know, until 60s, it was not clear what's really happening at r equal to r plus. And then, you know, people in 60s, they came up with the idea that maybe this object actually, you know, maybe it predicts really the solution of some new object, a black hole object. And then, of course, people started looking for them. But, of course, people who look for these things are astrophysicists or astronomers, and they are a very tough crowd. And so they are very hard to convince that objects like this could exist. So, for example, Eddington never actually believed that the stars actually can collapse. So he thought that the stars here are here and live forever, as the universe does. So you know, it was a very difficult battle. But I think now the astrophysicists are, of course, convinced that the black holes are there. And it took some lots of convincing to do that. OK, so now basically what you can do is that you can split black holes into three categories in our universe. And so the first category is the primordial black holes, which are simply characterized by the fact that they are tiny. And then you have the stellar mass black holes. And so they are basically the mass is something like the mass of the sun. And finally, you have the supermassive black holes. And their masses are amazing. So the mass is something like, let's say, 10 to the 8 solar masses. Of course, you know, they vary. The ranges of the masses vary. So, okay, so only two of these categories were observed. So this is just a theoretical possibility that we have primordial black holes. Nobody observed them. There are lots of papers about, you know, how we would observe them, what effect they might have. But these were not observed so far. On the other hand, we have seen lots of stellar mass black holes. And so they exist in binaries. And so the LIGO measured actually a collision of two stellar mass black holes. And finally, you have these supermassive black holes, which are at the centers of galaxies. And you know, they have different objects, like they are called quasars, blazars, and whatever. Depending. So what's happening is that you have the black hole, and the black hole is accreting some matter. So there's some matter flow inside the black hole. And if there's lots of matter accreting inside, then you also form jets. And if you form jets, then the jet is either pointing towards you or it's pointing somewhere else. And you know, depending on that, historically, astrophysicists call these objects differently. But now they all agree that it must be something like a supermassive black hole accreting these objects. And you know, different points of view give you a different picture. And so all these objects are actually just one object, the black hole object. All right? There's a huge puzzle about supermassive black holes. Nobody knows. So if you look at, so you can observe these supermassive black holes very early in our universe, like super early. Like, I don't know what the time scale is, but it's like super early. So now there is a limit on how fast you can actually accrete matter to form a bigger black hole. Of course, the black hole is formed at some mass. And then you start accreting matter. And as you accrete matter, you accumulate more and more mass. And the black hole is getting bigger and bigger. OK, so now there's a limit, which is called Eddington's limit, how fast you can accrete the matter inside. But if you look at the supermassive black holes and you observe them super early in the universe, there was not enough time to accrete this matter. So there is a puzzle how they are actually formed. So how are they formed? It's one of the big puzzles. that's one puzzle about the supermassive black holes. Another puzzle for the stale mass black holes. Well, these are the black holes which are caused, which are formed by a gravitational collapse of some supermassive star. So for example, you start with a red giant, and then you know, at the end of this life, it forms a black hole. And so then you predict the masses of the black holes, and you would expect something like, from theory, something like at most 10 solar masses. So now the first observation due to LIGO was actually 35 solar masses plus 30 solar masses. So it was way beyond the range. Okay, so it's actually much, much, much bigger black hole than you would expect based on statistics. Why they are so big, right? So they seem to be bigger, or at least we have only a few observations, right? And so then expected that's a question mark. Another question mark is you would expect that the black holes are actually super fast rotating, right? So wherever you accrete the matter, you actually increase the angular momentum. And so there is this. So basically, there's some calculations which people did a long time ago, and you should be observing that they are really super fast spinning. However, those observed in LIGO actually were not super fast spinning. So what's going on, right? So that's another question. So seems bigger than expected, and seem less spinning than expected. So that's another question. So you know, there may be lots of things we are learning from gravitational waves about black holes, which people didn't actually know before. So anyway, so these are just a few questions. Are there any questions? Yes.
What does the energy momentum density of a black hole look like?
Aha. What do you think?
I mean, some limit of the quantum.
Some limit of? So we are describing our black hole as the Schwarzschild metric, right? But the Schwarzschild metric is a vacuum solution. So there is no energy momentum tensor for the black hole. So if you take Schwarzschild metric all the way to r equal to zero, it's all the way to r equal to zero, it's a vacuum solution. And at r equal to zero, the solution breaks down. There is nothing at r equal to zero. There is a singularity. Singularity has to be removed from the manifold. So there is no energy momentum tensor anywhere in the space-time. Everything collapses to the point, but the point is removed. So there is no source for Schwarzschild black.
Can I just think about this from the perspective of coming from the first case, where you have a planet and then you have the Schwarzschild solution right outside the planet, and some other metric is falling inside the planet. So the black hole is just an immediate case in that situation.
If you want, but you know, so what people standardly understand as a black hole is that they understand the solution to be valid all the way to r equal to zero. Of course, you can have maybe some quantum gravity effects which prevent you to collapse all the way to r equal to zero, but so far there's no evidence for that.
Can you define a stress energy tensor which is like m times a delta, direct delta phi, in the direction of delta d, something like this? Won't this work?
Well, you can do m times delta r, but it doesn't make sense because r equal to zero is removed from the manifold. So there was a huge discussion about this. So Schwarzschild, but the guy who generalized the solution to higher dimensions, Tangerlini, he still believes that there is something at r equal to zero, but he's the only one in the community. All right. So the standard way is that you say this is simply a vacuum solution all the way to r equal to zero. Yeah.
So we can redefine our coordinates so that the Schwarzschild coordinates is not exactly 2m, right?
Sure. But the statement is this is like a, so these coordinates are preferred coordinates for the external observer.
Okay,
so this is something which, you know, they have some importance. They are those which become asymptotically flat coordinates at infinity. But of course, you can change these coordinates a little bit, differently, and then your horizon will be located at a different value of the coordinate, but it will be basically the same surface, right? The physical surface is the same. All right. So now let's leave black hole for now. We will return back to them tomorrow, and let's just concentrate on the first interpretation, that of the stars and planets and whatever. So now consider perihelion shift. shift, or mercury, and light bending, which are basically the two first experimental verifications of general relativity. Okay, and so other you could also call it Einstein's strength. Einstein's triumph. So the first observation is that, well, the Newtonian mechanics actually works very well for our planetary system, but there is a teeny tiny thing which people couldn't explain. And so what that is that you have the sun here, you have the sun, and then you have the Mercury, which goes on an elliptical orbit around the sun. But the problem is that it's not really an elliptical orbit. So let me just make it more apparent. So instead of forming an ellipse, the ellipse actually does not close, and instead is doing a precession. This doesn't work, but anyway, something like this. Okay, so there is not a closed elliptical orbit, but rather the ellipse is sort of precessing. This is actually moving around. The minimum approach to the sun is actually moving in this way. So there is a delta phi. There is a delta phi here. And this was, you know, very well measured by astronomers. And so this was really a departure from Newtonian theory. But the departure is super tiny. So the departure is 43. So delta phi is something like 43 arc seconds per century. So that's our Mercury here. This is Mercury. And so people measured 43 arc seconds per century. In fact, this delta phi is much, much bigger, but all of it can be explained by the presence of the other planets, by the motion of things and stuff like that. But if you take everything into account, then still what remains is 43 arc seconds per century. That's the physical thing which remains after removing all possible motions, all possible planets, and so on. All right, and so, of course, Einstein waited just one day after he found his equations to actually verify whether his theory gives these 43 arc seconds per century. And as we shall see very shortly, it indeed does. So actually then, Einstein was happy that his theory predicts this thing here. So surprisingly, that did not convince all the people. And actually, many people still remain very skeptic about Einstein's theory. First of all, they did not understand it. And second, they thought, well, he just designed his theory so that this is explained. Right? So this was the first triumph or whatever. But somehow people were not super impressed because they thought maybe the theory is just designed so that it precisely, you know, explains these 43 arc seconds. So it's not a new prediction of the theory. It's just I knew what I had to get, and so I got it, right? So I'm fiddling with the theory, I can get it, okay? But not super appreciated. Super appreciated. All right, but then there was another prediction, which is the light bending. And that was a completely new prediction of Einstein's theory. Okay, and so what it is that the best is that you consider light bending by the sun, and so you look at the stars, and something strange happens with the stars as the sun passes by. So let's say I have a star here, and I have a star here, and this is my observer. I'm observing it here. And so if there is no sun in between the stars and the observer, you would see the stars, you know, connected by this angle here. Okay? But suddenly, let's say that the sun gets in front of you. So then you have the sun here. But we already know that gravity is bending you know, trajectories. You know, that's why they move on geodesics, so now they follow the curved things. So what actually happens is that now the light sort of travels like this. Okay, and the same here. So the light bends around the sun. And so what you see is that because it bends, suddenly I don't see the stars as if they were here, but I see them as this line continued here, and as that line continued there, so I would see the other star there. And so I see the angle much bigger, okay, as the sun gets in front of you, okay, because of the line bending. So the stars get apart, as sun crosses by. And of course, that's a prediction of Einstein's theory. Okay, so that's something Einstein predicted. And so now it waited for its verification. And in fact, of course, this is a little bit problematic because stars are quite dim. And so if you have sun in front of them, then you cannot see the stars, right? So what you have to do is that you have to wait for an eclipse. So when the sun is there, but you actually you don't see it because it's eclipsed by the moon. So then you can see this effect, and then it was measured by Eddington in 1919. And so Eddington, although basically confirmed this effect, and then Einstein became a celebrity. And that really happened overnight. And so you have an opportunity to calculate this amazing verification of general relativity in your homework tree. Okay, and so this is like the second triumph of Einstein's theory, but this triumph is better because it's really a new prediction coming from the theory, which was then later actually verified and observed. This, the first triumph was that something was observed and Einstein's theory explained it. But then, you know, that raises some suspicion. But this one is just genuine new prediction. And you know, because it was observed, that's really made people believe that Einstein's theory is correct. By the way, at the time, there was this saying by Eddington, like, so he's like, people say that, what was it? That only three people in the world understand general relativity. So it's me, Einstein, but I don't know who is the third one. But he was certainly one of the first people to actually understand, you know, what's going on, and really he desired to measure this thing. And he is. Okay, so that's the truth. So now, interestingly, to understand both these effects, to understand both these truths, all you have to do is basically study geodesics in the Schwarzschild metric produced by the sun. Right, so I treat Mercury as a point particle of some mass m, which actually moves on geodesics around sun, and the corresponding metric around sun is the Schwarzschild metric, is basically vacuum. And similarly here, I just need to understand the motion of light around sun. So again, the corresponding null geodesic. Okay, so let's just do this. And so I will do the massive one, the perihelion shift. And then in your homework, you will do the other one. Questions? All right. So to understand and both phenomena, we study geodesics in Schwarzschild metric, around the sun. Okay, so now, of course, the metric is spherically symmetric, and as such, the angular momentum will be conserved, and so you can choose freely that the motion, so the motion will be planar motion. That's the same as in Newtonian physics. And you can choose the motion to be in theta equal to pi half plane. So spherical symmetry implies that the motion is planar. Motion is planar. And so we choose it to be at theta equal to pi half. Why not? Of course, if you choose anything else, it will be more complicated. So why not to simplify the life? So second thing, we know that there are two Killing vectors in the metric. The metric is static, and the metric is axisymmetric. Okay? So there are two Killing vectors. How do I call them? So I call them psi. Before was the dt Killing vector, and the other Killing vector is m, is d phi. So the metric is static. But because it's spherical symmetric, it's also axisymmetric. So then you go back to your parallel transport equations, parallel transport section, or to your tutorial, and you know that there is the corresponding integrals of motion for geodesics. You just take the Killing vector, multiply by the four velocity of the object, and that's a constant of motion, which remains the same. All right, so now the four velocity, u mu, which is dx mu, let's just put d lambda. Of course, for massive particles, we will want lambda equal to tau. But for light, we cannot do it because there is no proper time for light. Let's just put lambda here. And so the derivative with respect to lambda, I will just write dot here. So now the coordinates for Schwarzschild, I don't know, do I still have the metric here? No, I don't. So the coordinates for Schwarzschild are t, r, theta, and phi, right? So this is equal to t dot, r dot, theta equals to pi half, so theta dot is equal to zero, and phi dot. That's what the four velocity of the mercury is, or of the light is, okay? So that's the four velocity of the object. And then we know that we have two integrals of motion coming from these two Killing vectors. So one of them is u times psi. So u mu psi mu. Well, this is time-like Killing vector. So the value of the integral is actually negative because of the signature minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. So that's why people call this constant with a minus, so that they have positive constant. So one constant, let's call it e, is just given by minus u times psi. Minus is a convention, so we have positive number. Okay, so this is minus u mu psi mu. So now psi is 1, 0, 0, 0, if it's this index up, right? So what does this mean? This thing here, it means that if you understand psi as a vector, there's a 1 in the t direction, and then 0, 0, 0 in all the other directions, right? So what is this? It's minus u mu psi nu g mu nu. But the only non-trivial component of psi nu is the t component. Right? So this thing is actually just psi t, and that's 1. So this minus u mu psi t is 1, so it's g t nu. But the metric is diagonal. So this, if you are looking at g t something component, it has to be g t t. And g t t is just minus f. So this is just equal to whatever is it I'm doing. Something is wrong here, mu. Thank you. U mu gt mu. So there'll be only a t component here, which contributes. And there has to be only a t component here. So it's t dot. So it's f times t dot. OK? So So similarly, you would find that the other constant, let's call it L, is given by U times M, by this M. So by the same calculation, but now M looks like 0, 0, 0, 1, right? So then this is equal to, if you just calculate it, it's just G phi 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 dot, and this is just R square phi dot. All right, so that's two integrals. Well, the motion is in the plane, so the motion is actually three-dimensional motion. So we have t, it's motion in t, r, and phi, right? So it's also motion in t. So we need, in order to integrate this motion, we need three integrals of motion. Well, we have two, e and l, but for every geodesic, there's one extra. U square is minus one, okay? Or u square is, let's put minus kappa. Okay, so what is u square? Well, you just look at the metric, and instead of dt square, you just write t dot square, and instead of dr square, you just write out r dot square, and so on. So you just look at the metric, and this is equal to minus minus f t dot square plus r dot square over f plus r square. Now theta is equal to pi half, so sine theta, whatever. So the only thing which is left is just phi dot square, okay? And so kappa is a constant which is equal to 1 for massive particles and 0 for massless particles. So kappa equals to 1, kappa equals to 1 for massive, which will be the mercury. Or it's equal to 0 for the light. Okay, so when you study your homework, you will use the same equation, but now with kappa equals 0. All right, so that's our third integral of motion. So we have three integrals of motion, kappa, L, and E. And we have three-dimensional motion in t, r, and phi sector. Motion is completely integrable, and we should be able to integrate. Okay. So the way how you do it is that you plug the first two integrals to the last one. So basically, you solve the first two equations, e constant equals to ft dot for t dot. And then you solve the other one, l equals to r squared phi dot for phi dot. So you eliminate t dot and phi dot from the third equation. Okay, so we have an equation for r dot, then. So using first two equations, we get that minus kappa is equal to, so it's now minus f. So now t dot, what is t dot? So t dot is e over f. Over f square. That's what t dot square is. And then you have plus r dot square over f. And then you have plus r square. And then phi dot, and phi dot is L over R square. L over R square, mod square. Okay, so that's your equation for R dot. It's a radial equation. So now what you want to do is that you want to multiply by F, why not? And then multiply for some reason by 1/2 so that it looks nice. So then you can write this, so rewrite as 1/2 r dot square plus everything which you hate, you put in v, and then this is equal to 1/2 e square. Okay, so that's the equation where everything you hate looks like kappa over 2 minus kappa m over r plus l square over 2r square minus m l square divided by r cube. So V is called effective potential. It's called effective potential. Okay, so again, everything is so far still valid in the light case as well. So I'm doing your homework. Okay. So now let's depart you from your homework. So in your homework, the next thing you will do is that you plug kappa equal to 0. Instead, I plug kappa equal to 1. All right. So now let's concentrate on mercury. So for mercury, we know that kappa equals to 1. So the potential just looks like I plug everywhere kappa equal to 1. So V is 1/2 minus m over r plus l square over 2r square minus m l square over r cube. Okay. So now if you ever studied the Kepler motion using Newtonian physics, you would exactly arrive at the same equation. This is the same equation. So the potential would have some constant, 1/2, why not? It would have the gravitational force, well, the gravitational potential, which goes like minus m over r. What is this guy here? Does it exist in Newtonian physics?
Yeah.
It's the centrifugal force or whatever, right? So finally, this term is new one. So only this one is the GR correction. GR correction. So the potential, and so this is just the Newton, and this is the angular momentum part, so centrifugal or whatever, centrifugal. But anyway, all these three terms are what you would get in Newtonian theory. So the only thing doing GR is that you are getting this extra term, which goes like 1 over r cubed. All right. However, this extra term has some nice consequences. So if you plot the Newtonian potential, it's quite boring, right? So the Newtonian potential, if r goes to infinity, this goes to 1/2, right? If r is super small, which term dominates? It's this term here, if r is small, right? So it will go to plus infinity, right? So the Newtonian thing simply looks like, so Newtonian would look like if I plot V versus R. Well, it goes to infinity here, goes to 1/2 here, and then hopefully it has some bound orbits. So I have to have a minimum. So if I have a minimum, then I could have a bound orbit here. I would have my elliptic orbit or whatever. So this would be the Newtonian case. However, the Einsteinian case is different. So the Einsteinian case actually has this extra term here. Of course, this term for small r dominates. So instead of going up here, I actually go down. So this would be what Einsteinian result is. And so you can intuitively understand what's happening. So now actually you can distinguish two cases what's happening. So first you may be looking if there is an inflection point here. So the inflection point would be when V prime equals to 0 and V double prime equals to 0. That would be an inflection point. So you take this potential V here, you differentiate once and differentiate second time. I never differentiate in public. So I'll give you the result. If you solve this for something, then you find that L square is 12 m squared, and then r is equal to 6 m. Okay, so if you search for an inflection point, then you would find this thing here. So now this is very, very interesting. So there's some critical value of the angular momentum for which something happens. Okay, so now if you are at L squared bigger than 12 m squared, what do you think happens? So either you get to a Newtonian regime or you get to a general relativistic regime. So which one is which? So L squared bigger than 12 m squared is the Newtonian one or smaller? Huh? So say it again. So who thinks it's the Newtonian regime is actually L squared is bigger than 12 m squared? And you are correct again. Very good. So anyway, so you know, it's just analyzing this potential here, right? So you can plot it in Mathematica or whatever. So you get two different pictures. So if L squared is bigger than 12 m squared, then you basically get the picture which I was putting here. You get a maximum and you get a minimum there. So the potential looks like this. So V and R, and so the potential basically approaches the Newtonian one, and then it is a maximum, but then it goes down here. So you have a maximum here, and then you have a minimum here. And of course, the Newtonian one will then go like this. So this will be the Newton thing. And of course, in this case, you can have bound orbits at the minimum of the potential. So if the potential is minimum, then, well, for example, circular trajectory has r dot equal to 0. So when you have an energy which is precisely equal to the potential, then I'm just sitting here at a given radius and I'm doing a circular motion around the sun. If I have slightly bigger energy, then in Newtonian case, I will be changing radius from this value to that value, which precisely corresponds to the elliptic trajectory. If I am even bigger energy, then I am changing from this radius to infinity, which is the hyperbolic motion. Okay, so I'm a comet and I come from infinity and I swing around the sun and then I go back to infinity. Okay, of course now this is almost true, but this is a teeny tiny departure of Newtonian potential from the GR one. So even if I am doing this thing here, I am not actually in the elliptic trajectory, but I have the perihelion shift. Okay, so that's the difference. Very good. So this is this thing here. So now the other case is that L square is smaller than 12 m square, and so then the potential is boring, and so basically what it does is just goes down. Okay, so this is r, and so. So then there is no minimum, no maximum. Of course, the Newtonian thing would just look like this. So this will be Newton. And so you see a drastic departure from a Newton from GR. So what is true? So here, basically, no matter what I do, if I go here, I go all the way to r equal to 0, and I just fall into the black hole. So if your angular momentum is smaller than 12 m squared, you end up in the black hole. You end up in r equal to 0. Can you get in Newtonian theory to r equal to 0? What do you think? Not if L is bigger than 0. If L is equal to 0, I just shoot my particle exactly to the center, and I end up in the center. But if I shoot a little bit inside the center, so I have some angular momentum, I start oscillating around and I will never get to r equal to 0. But in GR, this is very different. For L squared smaller than this, I will end up at r equal to 0. Okay, so that's the huge difference. All right, so these are the two possibilities. And of course, if you want to study Mercury, we want to study And you know, basically the elliptic trajectory of the mercury, so the mercury is somewhere here in the potential. But the elliptic trajectory is not really elliptic because it's not closed. Okay, so let's concentrate on this case. So this is the case of mercury. So by the way, you can easily find that the minimum, so we found that the inflection point between this case and that case is at r equal to 6m. So now what you can show is that the minimum here is for radius bigger than 6m, and the maximum is for radius smaller than 6m. So this guy has r smaller than 6m, and the minimum has radius bigger than 6m. Okay, but we know that 2m radius, the horizon radius of the black hole, is super small. Okay, so 6m is also super small. So actually, when we want to describe the trajectory of the mercury, we are in the regime when the radius is much, much bigger than 6m, right? So for mercury, mercury is the regime that we are actually on an elliptic trajectory. But if you look at the ellipticity of that trajectory, then you will actually see that it's super small. In fact, the trajectory is almost circular. So for mercury, the trajectory almost circular. And r is much, much bigger than m. All right, so now comes, I have to calculate. So I have this potential here. So I'm basically like near this minimum here. And then I want to find the trajectory, and I want to find this angle delta phi. Okay, if you open Sean Carroll's book, calculation is in 3 pages. Okay, let me do it in 3 lines. All right. So first thing is that we say the trajectory is almost circular. Okay, what it means is that we are trying to find the minimum here. That's where the circular trajectory is. Okay, so what we want is that v prime is equal to 0. And we are in the regime that r is bigger than 6m. So v prime equals to 0. Okay, we have to differentiate v prime. Never differentiate in public. So anyway, differentiating this thing, super simple. We have to solve this equal to 0 for something. So it would be very stupid to solve it for the radius of the trajectory, because you have to solve the quadratic equation. Instead, let's solve for L squared. Okay, solve for L squared. And what you get is that from there, L squared is just m times circular radius square rc minus 3m. Okay, so that's the first equation. We know that we are in the circular trajectory, where v prime equals to 0, we are solving that what our angular momentum has to be. Okay, that's the first equation. Second equation is, well, we are not exactly circular, right? We are sort of moving around this circular trajectory in slow motion. Okay, so what are you doing? We have a harmonic oscillator around the minimum of the potential. Okay, what is the frequency of that harmonic oscillator? It's just potential 2 derivatives of that, right? That's the frequency around the minimum. So the second equation is that the radial oscillations are just given by 2 derivatives of the potential. So that's the radial oscillations around the minimum. Radial oscillations around the circular trajectory. All right, so very good. Of course, this is evaluated at r equal to rc. At r equal to rc. So what you have to do, you take that potential, and you take 2 derivatives of that potential, and evaluate it at r equal to rc. But what it means is that I plug, whenever I see L square, I plug this value here. Okay. So what you find is that this thing is equal to m times rc minus 6m. Divided by rc cube, rc minus 3m. Okay, so upon using the first expression. So that's my second equation. Okay, I need one more. So we now know you know, how much time it takes to complete my elliptic trajectory. That's the radio frequency here. Okay? But at the same time, we know how much time it takes to actually circle around an angle 2 pi. That's the angular frequency. Okay, so then we have omega phi frequency. I'll be done in 3 minutes, hopefully. So the third equation is the angular frequency. That equation is the angular frequency. But the angular frequency, what is it? It's d phi over dt in some given time. But what is d phi over dt? Well, it's phi dot. Okay, the frequency, angular frequency, is just phi dot. So it's given by L over R squared. Okay, so the angular frequency omega phi square. Omega phi square is just L square over RC to the 4. And again, I can plug 4 L square this relation here. So this is equal to m times RC square RC minus 3m, which is this equation here. All right. But now, look at that. I have a time it takes to do oscillation like this. But then I have a time it takes to complete a circle in the angle 2 pi. If this time doing this is the same as that one, or a multiple of, then I have a closed trajectory. If they are not the same, I don't have a closed trajectory. So if omega phi is a multiple of omega r, and the trajectory is closed. But if they are not the same, so what you are interested in is the difference between omega r and omega phi. And that's how much longer it takes to do the oscillation in this direction than oscillation in that direction. So then you have the precession frequency. Precession frequency is just omega p, which is omega phi, how long it takes to complete the trajectory here, minus omega r. Okay, so you have an expression for omega r, it's square root of this. You have an expression for omega phi, it's square root of that. Okay, so now everything is in the regime where rc is much bigger than m. So you can express this in terms of the dimensionless quantities and expand in small m over r. Okay, so this is equal to 3m to 3 halves divided by rc to 5 halves. Okay, so that's, I'm doing the expansion in small m over rc. Well, so finally, you may be interested in the angle. So this is the precession frequency. If I want the angle, delta phi, it sweeps in some given period. So let's say I have a period. This is my orbital period. So in a given orbital period, let's say, well, this is the angle I sweep. And if you just plug everything here, and you use the, so this is 6 pi m square over L square, upon using the Keplerian thing, Kepler thing that t square is 4 pi RC cube divided by m. Okay, so that's the Kepler law. Third Kepler law that the period it takes is t square over RC cube is a constant. So this is how much I sweep of the angle, how much precession there is per one period. But of course, now you are not interested in one period, but you are interested in century. So you just multiply by a century instead of a period, and you get exactly 43 arc seconds. So this is the amazing proof, the first proof of general relativity. And you see that the calculation is actually basically 4 lines. Okay, so are there any questions? So Fermi, super simple. Of course, if you want to find the trajectories, that's pain. You have to do perturbation theory and blah, blah, blah. And you know, that takes several pages. But to calculate the frequency, which is what we are after, this is amazing shortcut. I just compare the frequency here and compare the frequency there. And that's how my precession frequency is. And I multiply by arbitrary period, and I get the angle. OK, so let me stop here.